All right, everybody, welcome into another edition of Silver Lining Podcast. I am Adam. Across from me always is Uncle Rex, and some of you like to call him Grunkle Rex. And so, you know, with our podcast, we've had several guests on. Rex and I like to learn. We like to grow. We like to heal. All those things are associated with our podcast. We try to find silver linings in our podcast with the tragedies that everybody goes through in life, especially ours. And we've had Dr. Denham on before a couple of times. And I just feel like he's very, he explains things easy for us to understand them, which I love because I love to learn. And so, Dr. Denham, first of all, thanks for coming on again with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, Rex, is this your second, third, or fourth therapist? I can't remember where he is his on the line.
Yes, it is.
Just yes.
It takes a village when you're really messed up. But some people may not have heard previous times when Dr. Denham's been on. So, Denham, would you start by just giving a brief background and your qualifications, what you're doing now, and then going into your subject, if you would?
Yeah. So my name is Denham Slade, and I have my doctorate from Ohio State, The Ohio State University. I have been married for almost 30 years, have five kids, ranging from 26 to 9. And I was a marriage family therapist for over 20 years before moving into coaching a few years ago. And I have a coaching program that I've developed and have five coaches that I've trained and certified that do our core healthy and happy program. And then also own a TMS clinic, TMS Success here in St. George. And so, yeah, and I have my personality book on core. And so I probably have way too many things going on, but that's kind of a 10,000 foot view of my life, I guess.
What's going on? We did appreciate when you came on and talked about core, because that was eye-opening for a lot of people. And we have so many comments about that as well.
And we anticipate today's subject will be equally as eye-opening. So tell us about attachment styles, Denham.
Yeah, so I mean, these two things, core and attachment, inform almost everything that I do or have done across the eons that I've been doing this stuff. Attachment theory, many of you may have heard of attachment theory. Attachment theory is a theory of human development that helps us understand the important role of and how intimate relationships in our lives work, either work functionally or dysfunctionally. And an attachment style is a rule book that gets literally wired into each of our brains that dictates how we handle really important relational moments in our lives. There's a system in the brain. It's called the attachment system. And the function, the job of this system, just like other systems in our brains, the job of this system is to monitor and manage connection. Its job is, it dictates what we do in order to regulate our connection with each other. And every single one of us has two primary needs that are constants, across non-negotiables across the lifespan. The first one is a need to feel like we matter to the people that we're supposed to matter to, that we're valued by the people that we should be valued by. And the second need is to feel like we're safe, that we're emotionally safe with the people that we're supposed to be emotionally safe with. And these two needs are with us constantly. And when those needs are being met, we talked a little about this before, I think, when these needs are being met, we don't tend to pay very much attention to them. But when they're, because that's how it's supposed to be, right? That's the default way that relationships are supposed to function. And when those needs are not being healthfully met, our brains will automatically do something to try to get those needs met. And so, in its simplest form, attachment style is a belief system about those two needs. Do I expect to matter to the people that I'm supposed to matter to? And do I expect to be emotionally safe with them? And attachment style gets set by about age three. During the first, and most of us, I mean, if you stop and ask yourself, okay, what's my first earliest memory? Adam, what's your first earliest memory?
Well, literally maybe 4 or 5. I remember some things in kindergarten. I think I remember one time being in the back of a Volkswagen driving my grandma to Grandma Noni to her work with my mom was driving. And literally, I think that's my earliest, and I think I may have been 4 or 5. And I think that's the earliest I can remember.
Yeah. Rex, what about you?
And that's, Adam, because your mom's driving was so traumatic.
Right.
That's why you remember it.
Yeah.
I remember just because I've seen the movies, the home movies of it, being 2 years old, being hit in the face with a baseball bat by my brother.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you remember it, or do you know it happened because of the movie?
Well, I don't know. I'm guessing I know it happened because of the movie. So I guess one of my earliest memories would be living in England as a 3-year-old and some of the sights and sounds there.
Yeah, and that's pretty consistent. For most of us, our first earliest memory is somewhere around 3 or 4. And 80% of the brain gets wired by age 3, and about 90% of the brain gets wired by age 5. And so attachment style, this belief system, what attachment style is, it's a belief system about those two needs. It's a rule book that dictates how we respond when we're disorganized emotionally. And so it gets wired before most of us have any conscious memory. And so we don't even realize the subjective nature of that belief system, because for our conscious memory, it's always been with us. And so one of the scary things about attachment style is that the research shows that for most people, it never changes. It gets wired by about age 3, and most of us stay with that same belief system for the rest of our lives. Wow. That's the scary part. The really optimistic and encouraging part is that it can be rewired at any point in life. We just normally don't do the work necessary to be able to do that. And that kind of comes back to your question and why I'm here, which is, you know, what does trauma do to that belief system? And so, am I making sense in terms of what attachment style is?
Yeah. I think when you give us the actual attachment styles that we can all relate to, it'll all come together there.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are three main attachment styles that have been identified in the literature. There's a secure attachment style, an avoidant attachment style, and an anxious or preoccupied attachment style. And how that belief system gets wider during those first 3 years of life depends on what happens between an infant and her or his caregivers during what are called attachment moments. And attachment moments are moments when they're called disorganizing events. And so those are the things that activate that part of the brain. And so what's a disorganizing event? It's you're scared, you're hurt, you're lonely, you're sad, you're anxious or nervous. It's any time we're experiencing an intense emotion, whether it's a positive or a negative emotion. That's one of the things that turns on that rule book in our brains. And so what happens during those first 3 years of life around those moments is what determines and wires the attachment style in our brains. And so a secure attachment style gets wired when during attachment moments, I am met with availability and sensitivity from my attachment figures. Most of the time, when I'm scared or when I'm hurt, I have access to them, and I receive a sensitive response from them. And so what does my brain learn? But well, around those two needs, my brain learns that I matter in terms of myself. What do I think? Do I expect to matter? A securely attached person expects to matter to the people that they're supposed to matter to. And they expect to be safe with the people that they're supposed to be safe with. Why? Because that's what happened most of the time during those moments, during those first 3 years of life. And the good news for parents and for partners is that, because nobody's perfect, right? There's no parent that is perfectly sensitive and available. There's no partner that is. And the great thing is that pattern is what matters. What happens most of the time is what will determine the attachment style. And so if most of the time during those attachment moments, we're met with sensitivity and availability, 85% of the time is a great number. If that's if most of the time, we can screw it up 15% of the time and not wire an unhealthy attachment style. So how do secure people look? Secure people enter relationships fairly easily. They open up fairly easily. They're willing to be vulnerable. Why? Because they expect to matter and they expect to be safe. So they handle those attachment moments, those disorganizing events, healthier than anybody else. Detached people or avoidant people, that style develops during those first 3 years of life. When the message is, as long as you're not a problem to me, you can hang around. If I'm the parent, as long as you don't make my life too difficult or you're not too big of a pain in my butt, then you can hang around. Because what the little infant brain is trying to figure out is, what's the most likely strategy for me to be able to obtain and maintain access to you? A human child dies if they're unable to figure out how to get access to their attachment figure. And so what's the most likely strategy? And so if the message that's sent is, don't be a problem and don't make my life difficult and you can hang around, then the child learns, okay, I need to not make my needs known. I need to go inside. I need to not cause any waves. And so they learn to mute or to swallow their attachment needs. And so what do they expect? They expect people not to be there for them. They expect to not be able to trust relationships. And in terms of being emotionally safe, they don't expect to be safe. They don't expect sensitivity and availability during those moments. And so how do these people look in adulthood? They build walls. They're very slow to warm up. They believe that relationships are not safe. And so when somebody starts to get close, the rule book, the attachment style says, this isn't a good idea. And so the avoidant brain starts looking for reasons to create space. That can look like becoming critical of the other person, romanticizing past relationships, look, any sort of like, maybe this isn't meant to be. I should be, if I really loved you, I would feel more excited about this. The brain will look for any and all excuse to justify creating space. So when people are really hard to get close to and really confusing, because then they have the same needs, right? They still want to matter. They still want to be safe. And so they do these things to create space. They have a hard time moving relationships forward when it's time to do so. But then when the other person is like, well, okay, well, if we're not moving forward, I'm going to move on. Then all of a sudden the avoidant person is like, I don't leave me. And so they'll show up and they'll be real responsive and sensitive and engaged, and they'll do just enough to keep you from leaving. And then when you turn around and you start coming in again, then they're like, oh, that's so close. You know, I didn't want you to leave, but I don't want you right here either. And so it becomes this really confusing dance when you're in a relationship with somebody who's avoidant. Because when they're on, they're typically wonderful. They're passionate. Sex can be super passionate. Interest, that there can be really great stuff. But then it's super confusing because then you're like, oh, okay, we're going somewhere with this. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, no, no, no. And so it can be really difficult to do that. The third attachment style is an anxious or a preoccupied attachment style. And this develops during those first 3 years of life when there's an inconsistent pattern. When sometimes you're there during attachment moments and sometimes you're not. Sometimes you're sensitive and sometimes you're not. And so the brain doesn't know what to do with that. So I don't know if I come crying to you, if you're going to take me in your arms and tell me everything's going to be okay, or if you're going to tell me to suck it up and quit being a wimp. And so there's this confusion of, man, sometimes this works and sometimes it doesn't. What's the equation? You know, if I whine, does it work? If I'm a really good boy, does it work? If I tell you everything you want to hear, does that work? So there's the avoid or the anxious brain and the anxious rule book says, I don't trust that I'm going to matter. Back to those two core needs. I don't trust that I'm going to matter. And I have to be constantly monitoring whether or not I have access to you and whether or not I'm emotionally safe with you. So anxious people are constantly seeking, but continuously doubting. They're waiting for the other shoe to drop, and they're constantly looking for snakes in the grass. Where's the danger sign? Is it your coworker? Is it your workout regimen? Is it your job? Is it your church? You know, what's going to be the thing that's going to take you away from me? And so they move into this really hyper-vigilant monitoring because they don't trust that you're not going anywhere and that I'm going to matter to you and that I'm going to be safe with you. Okay. That makes sense. Oh, one more thing here. So in terms of the population, research shows that about 50% of the population is securely attached, has a secure attachment style. Between 22 and 25% have an avoidant attachment style, and between 22 and 25% have an anxious attachment style. So a lot of the times, we tend to keep finding what we're attracted to. So frequently, anxious people will find themselves in relationships with avoidant people. Why? Because they give them exactly what they expect to get. And so on a subconscious level, anxious people are subconsciously attracted to that because that's what they expect from the intimate relationships in their lives. And so it can really feel like, man, this is all that's out there. But the reality is that there are a lot of healthy people, at least healthy in this regard, out there. Mm-hmm. And if you're not finding them, it's probably because what you're attracting, or you don't know how to do it. So learning about how to do that, but if you're thinking that's an impossibility to find someone healthy, it's not. You just got to learn how to do it.
Is it possible to be all three of those, or you have to? You're literally one of the three. There's no way you can be a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and a little bit of that.
Typically, no. So there's a fourth. That's a good question, Adam. There's a fourth attachment style that the research has identified that's called the disorganized attachment style.
Yes. I am disorganized. Yes, put me in that category right now. Let me hear it.
That is both avoidant and anxious.
Yeah, I think that's me too. And I like the other one, secure. So I feel like there's a little bit of each one of those in me, but maybe
and again, they're not. These are not like ironclad boxes that we get in. It's a pattern, right? But what attachment style is? It's a blueprint or a rule book in the background, behind the scenes, puppeteering how we react to these things. And most of us aren't even consciously aware that it's going on. It's just under the surface dictating how we respond in these moments. And so most everybody has a pretty dominant style that will show up. Now, you might act differently with friends than with a spouse.
Gotcha.
Or with a parent than a sibling. But almost always you'll have a subconscious rule book that will dictate when you start dating somebody or you're getting serious with somebody, you'll have one of these patterns that will show up. That doesn't mean you can't have tendencies in some of the others.
I'm trying to think, just trying to date. That's the whole thing is like, am I, if it gets too close to becoming a real relationship, am I bailing ship? Cause I just don't think can do it, or I'm scared about doing it,
right,
or whatever. So am I the one that's pushing it away? Are they the one that's pushing it away? I started thinking about that.
Yeah. And you should be. That's
some urgency denim for Adam to get this figured out. There are several optimists waiting on the results of him.
I think he has a secure attachment style. And those of you that are listening should. if you have an avoidant attachment style, you will, at least on a subconscious level, be pushing opportunities away.
Yeah.
You have to really fight the subconscious current to do something opposite of your attachment style. And the good news is that it is rewritable. You also bring up a really interesting point in terms of the effect that trauma can have on this. So most of the time, we don't change our attachment style because we keep getting the same data from the close relationships in our lives. And a lot of the time, that happens because we're engaging in ways that get us what we expect. So for example, I don't know how to demonstrate this. If I'm avoidant, this is how I engage in relationships. If you're trying to connect to me, this is what you're trying to connect with. Well, if you're trying to connect, how does that feel?
Just sad.
Feels bad, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, hey, let me in, right? Well, if you're healthy, what are you going to do if this is what I'm doing?
Do the same thing? No.
You gotta give it a chance, but not forever.
Right, exactly. If you're healthy, you're gonna tap my shoulder and say, hey, Denim, let me in, right?
Turn around. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you're gonna come around here and you're gonna say, hey, let me in, right? But if you keep getting met with this, if you're healthy, eventually you're going to leave. Because healthy people don't stay in unhealthy relationships forever. And so if you're healthy and I'm avoidant and that's what I'm giving you, eventually you're going to leave. And what's my blueprint and my rule book going to say when you leave?
I knew it.
Of course he left me. Everybody does.
Right.
That relationships can't be trusted. And so, but why did you leave? Did you leave because you weren't willing? Or because of how I engaged with you?
Well, also, I feel like, you know, at least in my situation where I was super close to my mom and dad, my sister Summer, and then when this tragedy happened, we split. And so my trust, my all my love, my security, all the things that you mentioned about being secure, the way I've grown up, all these things, they're all gone. And they were gone for 2 years during that time. And so I don't know what traumatic effect that has on me now going forward, trying to find a wife or trying to be in a relationship. Did that change my direction because now I have trust issues or, you know, whatever it is?
It depends on how you lived them. It depends on how you interpret them. There's tons of data that show that the way that we interpret something influences and even determines the effect that it has on us. There's some kind of fascinating research that's kind of interesting on they'll do these little vignettes or scenarios where they'll have if somebody breaks into your house and you are running away and fall down the stairs and break your ankle, that's scenario number one. What effect does that have on you than if you're playing with your kid and step on a toy and break in, have the same injury? And the research shows that the likely interpretation of the first event makes healing more difficult. It makes leads to many more complications in the healing process and the long-term effects of that, even though it's the same injury. And so the way that we interpret something does influence the way that we, the effect that it has on us. And the things that change attachment style are either long-term exposure to a pattern. So if you have an avoidant attachment style and you get in a relationship with somebody with a secure attachment style that responds with sensitivity and availability consistently over time, research shows that will slowly change an attachment style. And a big event, a big trauma, a big crisis can also shock our worlds enough that it throws the pieces of the puzzle in the air, and then they come down in a different way. But in terms of controlling what you can control, in terms of the effect that this tragedy has on you and your attachment style, really comes down to you understanding what healthy is and what's going on, and then you being able and willing to navigate that and interpret it in an accurate way. If that makes sense.
Yeah. It does. I started thinking about that because I know people that are either one of the three of those. And I thought at one point, I was like, well, maybe I have a little bit of all of that. But I think now looking back at it, I think I'm secure. I think I follow that pattern more than I do the other ones. But I feel like maybe sometimes I have a flash of the other ones, which I don't know why that is or how that happened.
Well, and I don't even know, I don't even know a portion of what you've gone through, but with some of the traumatic events that you've experienced, that certainly challenges a secure belief system, right? I mean, that's like this big chunk of data that is incongruent with what your rule book believes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that creates a scenario where you have to decide, okay, what's going to win? Is my rule book and my history going to win, or is this new data going to win? And so living what you've lived, if you came into these tragedies with a secure belief system, and then you have these big data points, your brain and your psyche has had to decide. And it normally happens on a subconscious level. The more conscious that process can be, the better. But at the very least, on a subconscious level, yourself has had to figure out who's going to win in those moments.
So, Denham, does this tie into what we hear about relationships as a result of trauma, or relationships often strained? Do the people know how to deal with this? How does it tie into relationships of people that have dealt with trauma?
Yeah, it can be. And you can have trauma bonding that can occur. I mean, you can, lots of different things, but generally what happens is trauma tends to reinforce whatever is. It's kind of like the holidays. You know, when you go into the holidays, holidays tend to magnify whatever's going on. And so if you've got, really healthy, good relationships, then being together and having more time together tend to strengthen those bonds. If you've got strain and stress in relationships, and then all of a sudden you're spending a bunch of time together, it tends to exacerbate the strain and stress. And so that's what trauma tends to do with attachment style is to reinforce it. It tends to solidify, again, because we typically will cope in ways that get us what we expect. And so if I am anxious and I go into a trauma moment, then my brain is going to be anxious in how it deals with that. And I'm going to be hypervigilant, and I'm going to be looking for reconfirmation everywhere, and I'm going to be texting 500 times, and my brain is going to want to make it about me and what it means about me. And a lot of times as I engage, we call those protest behaviors. As I engage in those protest behaviors, I'm going to be taxing the other people in the relationship. And they may be like, oh, you're a little much, right? You're too much. This isn't about you or whatever. And there again, that's going to get me the kind of reaction that I expect to get. And it's going to confirm my belief system. Or if I'm avoidant, I might kind of hang back on the periphery and really not engage with the system, but kind of feel bad that I'm not being invited in, right? And so other people may not quite know how to engage with me because I'm not really there, but I'm kind of there. And so then they might not include me. And then my brain's going to say, yeah, they don't really care if I'm here. They don't want me here or whatever. And so most often, Rex, we engage, just whatever it is gets reinforced exponentially during trauma moments.
So there's two things that you said that I want to just bring up. So I know two different sets of couples. They both lost a child. One couple decided that's going to keep them together and bond them, and the other couple got divorced and it's separate, and they got divorced because of it. So you're saying once trauma hits in a relationship like that, you either are going to go all in or all out.
Yeah, it tends to just exacerbate what. And I think I mentioned on here, but we have a child that we lost to a terrible accident, and the data is kind of hard to pinpoint, but upwards of 80% of people who lose children end up getting divorced.
It's more divorced than it is staying together.
Yeah, it's a huge stressor that tends to. And the exact accuracy of that 80%, some of the studies are kind of hard to.
Well, I was super surprised at one couple that their son got, killed in a terrible way. And they ended up getting divorced. And I was like, divorced? They had started a foundation together about what happened to their son and all these things happened. And the next thing you know, they're getting divorced. I was like, oh my gosh, I couldn't believe that.
Right. And that happens a lot. And again, most of the time it is because it accelerates, so much of the stuff that kind of goes on under the surface in a relationship. Events like that kind of pull the covers back and expose what's going. It makes a lot of that covert stuff overt, and it accelerates.
It makes sense. It does make sense. Yeah. There's probably a lot of couples that are together right now that, maybe if something did happen traumatically, they would split because there's nothing really that traumatic that they just stay together. And I think there's a lot of relationships like
that. Oh, tons. Right. And the research would say that number could be as high as 80% of us.
Yeah.
Would not be able to withstand that kind of a stressor.
Yeah. Interesting stuff, though, man.
Yeah, so insightful too. And you think, of course, all of us are relating to ourselves first as you talk through this, and I'm, trying to figure out what we are and what our relationship is, what the dynamics are, past relationships. It's just fascinating. And a lot of questions. So I know you started a group online recently. Is that available to our optimists?
Kind of a fun thing that I've been working on for years that is now just barely in fruition. And that's we've created an online portal. It's called the Core Healthy and Happy Community. And And it is, it's built on, you know, from my research, my healthy and happy system is built on 7 research-based principles that are necessary in order for our lives and relationships to be going well. Our relationships with ourselves and our relationships with others, our relationships with God. There's a lot of things that are great to have going on in our lives, but there are certain things that if they're not going on, our lives and relationships will not be going well. And so that's what the 7 healthy and happy principles are built on. And so we've created this community that has over 350 assets in it. And my goal with this community has been to have an affordable place where people can get really good, reliable information and skills and tools. And so it's $10 a month, which is super cheap. And there are already over 350 assets in there with handouts and videos and homework. And there's a community component. So we're just launching it, but it's super something I'm really excited about because not everybody can afford to go to coaching or to therapy, and not everybody can afford to be able to do the things to get good information. And there's so much information out there, and so much of it is garbage, frankly, and it can be really confusing to know where to go to get good information. And so I've really wanted a place where people that couldn't necessarily afford to get more intensive help could still have a place where they could go and get really good information to help them make changes in their lives. And so that's what the portal's about.
Love it. And I hope you're on a lot of podcasts that are very professional. And at this point, they've put up a graphic with how to get to that site. You aren't on that podcast right now. So would you tell us the site and we will get it.
Yeah.
The information out.
Yeah. And in fact, I do have a thing, I don't know if we can put it, I'll send it to you, Rex, but it's, there's a link here that takes you right to it. It's you.drdenhamslade.com. And I'll send you the link.
I'll type it.
Okay. I'll take
you. Dr. Denham Slade.
you.drdenhamslade.com.
Of course I have it in since I'm in the community.
Yeah. Yeah, there it is.
You're already part of the community.
Yes.
He's an early adopter.
I love it.
And I also...
So there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
There it is. Oh, that's cool.
There you go.
How'd you do that? That's really cool. Well,
he's good at sharing a screen. He's learned so much.
Share. I play nice and share. Okay. U-Y-O-U. And nothing else is capitalized or punctuation.
Yeah.
Not DR for Dr. Denham, D-E-N-I-M, as you can see on the screen, Slade, SLADE.com.
Yeah.
For those of you listening on the podcast.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to have you come and join our community and be, you know, bring your, what you two are have and continue to establish here is so awesome. And there's such a need for people to have a place of, a happy and an optimistic place for people that want to heal and
yeah.
And want to find the silver linings in their lives. And so I think it's so awesome how you have and are working to turn a tragedy into a place of healing. And I just major kudos and I really commend what the two of you have already done and continue to do here.
Thank you. And it turns out it's many tragedies because we have people share their tragedies. Our optimists come on and share them, and everyone has them. You know, no one is spared. So,
no one is spared.
Whole community of healing, people wanting healing, needing healing, offering healing, supporting each other. It's just wonderful. And once again, I know you have professional commitments here. And so once again, we run out of time as we usually do, but Adam and I are experimenting with a couple of ideas, and I'll get in touch with you, Denham, and see if you'll join us again and continue participating with us.
Awesome. It's super great to see you both.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. It's got a lot for me to think about today, so this will be good. I'll go back and rewatch this again.
All right. Let me know if you have any questions.
All right. Well, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Hey, talk to you later.